Hey, we're back. Another Sunday. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer, and this is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. Our sponsor today is...
Hearst Ranch.
All right.
Ooh, that's a nice change.
Yeah.
The Hearst have been very good to us. We just sold about 50 head of their cattle to 50 restaurants, and then we sold 108 orders. We sold half cows
right
to restaurants and 8 animals, which
that's beautiful.
Like 40 pounds to home chefs.
When you sell an 8th, do you sell like the chuck roll, the back of the leg? I mean, what when you sell
it,
is it just the middle
piece of everything?
Oh, you get a little piece of everything.
Yeah, including a lot of ground. But you
right.
do get, there's one thing you don't get. You either get skirt or flank. I think it's something like that,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's not enough to go around.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, how was your week, Katie?
It was hectic, but I'm glad to be here at the main course out in beautiful Bushwick at Roberta's Restaurant, where I'll be enjoying some of their first-class pizza later on this afternoon.
Oh, I can't wait. And let me ask, what do you do? You also work with Food Art sometimes.
I
do you go into their office and have a desk there?
No, I don't. I work freelance for them. I'm a contributing editor, so I write stories for them a few times a year. And in general, I tend to write stories about the meat industry. That yeah. just seems to be what I'm most interested in. I spent a long time, as you know, Patrick, working as a butcher.
Butcher, I have to. We have to unpack that.
So
we should have you as a guest on the show.
Well, actually, I'd love to do a show about butchering. We should get Tom Milan on and a couple of the other people who are...
I'd love to get the Ottomanelli brothers.
Yeah, right? Or there's another group that I worked with, the guy that was my head butcher when I was on the Upper West Side at Broadway Butcher, who has moved over to Simcheck on the East Side and is
I
one of the
it.
Last of the old-time butcher shops.
I love
really?
Simcheck's. They're a block away from my house.
No
they used
way.
To be 3 blocks next to Ideal Cheese Shop
yeah.
and Piscayenne. The fish shop. And
unbelievable. So do
bucks.
You know Paul Redder?
I mean, I
he's
have
the guy with the mullet.
Yes, I do know him. I see him at Jimbo's and for breakfast. But I have so much beef and pork at my house because
yeah,
of
yeah,
my business.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Well, today we're talking about chocolate. So let's talk about who we have with us. We have John Payson, who is the proprietor of the Chocolate Room, which has opened up its second location in Brooklyn in the last year. John, you're going to be telling us all about that in a little while. And we also have Roger Rodriguez today from the Gramercy Tavern. He's the chocolatier, and I'm
very
looking
exciting.
Forward to talk about unpacking that story.
When I called Mike Anthony, I was like, could we get like your pastry chef to talk about chocolate? He's like, we have a chocolatier, you know. I'm like, oh, that's awesome.
That's I don't think that's right. common to have a chocolatier. Is that right?
It's really weird.
It's really weird. That's what I thought. Well, we're going to get to you in a few minutes, but for now, let's start with our buddy John here.
And by the way, I did some research, and I heard there's milk chocolate and dark chocolate. Have you heard that?
I not only have heard that, I've experienced that.
Oh,
yeah.
So
in
much
fact,
time
I was
time.
Working with chocolate yesterday. I made a chocolate cake, a huge 2-sheeter chocolate cake with chocolate glaze. And
very
I used a pound of Calibo chocolate, and I melted it down with a couple of sticks of butter and a half a pint of cream, and it really came out as a glaze. I was amazed because chocolate, as Roger is going to tell us, is really tricky to work with. So
fondue of chocolate. I love that. No one does fondue anymore. There's like
no.
Anyway, well.
We do fondue.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It's very popular.
John, welcome to
yeah,
the
welcome
program.
Welcome to the show. I'm very excited
you
could come.
Thank
and
you
I'm
for
sorry your
me.
Wife, Naomi, couldn't join us, but we'll have her another time when we talk about chocolate again.
Where Let's is your store?
We have 2 shops. Our first location, we opened about 4 years ago in Park Slope on 5th Avenue.
Okay.
And then our second location, we opened last July on Court Street in Cobble Hill.
And it's called The Chocolate Room.
It is.
And so you guys are a dessert cafe, or are you a full-service restaurant?
We're basically a chocolate-themed dessert restaurant, if you will, and a chocolate shop, sort of boutique chocolate shop within that.
Are you a chocolatier yourself?
I am a chocolate eater.
Oh, see? Okay.
Yeah.
How did you get the idea for this?
Well, I love chocolate, and my wife, Naomi, and I love dessert. I was trying to do the rock star thing for a long time, and as I was getting older, realized, okay, I've got to switch gears. And
you mean you literally wanted to be a rock star?
Oh, yeah. Well, in my own mind, I am. But
well, of course. And
yes.
I can tell by looking at you, you're a total rock star.
Yeah.
But what was your instrument?
I'm a drummer.
And you played in a rock band?
Yeah. I played in a few different rock bands over the course of the last 15 years
uh-huh.
in New York City. Did all the clubs, CBGBs and Arlene's Grocery and all of that. But in realizing that that was as far as it was going to go for me, I wanted to switch gears and get into something that I also enjoyed and was interested in. I didn't know
at
the time.
And make money.
Yeah, Mike, yes. I didn't know at the time a lot about chocolate, but I love chocolate and I love dessert. And, of course, being a musician, you have a lot of restaurant experience. So
Yeah, right. John, let me ask you this. My feeling about chocolate is that, and one of the reasons I wanted to do a show about chocolate today was that chocolate has undergone this incredible transformation over the last, I'd say, 5-6 years. Would you agree with that? Would you agree with that too, Roger?
Wholeheartedly, yeah.
So, and it was unfortunate because we were hoping today to have Natalie Markoff on, who is Katrina Markoff's sister, and I think Vogue was very much in the vanguard of changing people's perception of chocolates. I wanted to get that sort of PR angle, but anyway, we couldn't line her up. So tell me a little bit about how, like, instead of just going for kind of a dessert cafe thing, you thought, wow, you know, is the time right for a chocolate-themed thing? I mean, did you have that specific sense that chocolate was going to really take off or was taking off when you started?
I wouldn't say I knew that it was going to take off. I think that's we were in the right place at the right time with the right idea based upon what was already going on in the market. With at the time, there was a little article in Time Out New York, and they profiled the chocolate bar, the chocolate garden, Marie Bell and Jacques Therese. And around that time, I was looking at the various chocolate shops that were happening, and I went and visited them, and actually Naomi and I did, and realized that the experience could extend much farther out than what was going on. Those are all great shops. I mean, fantastic.
Totally. I love the chocolate bar. In fact, I called them too, but they didn't get back to me in time to get on the show.
Yeah.
You snooze, you lose, man.
Yeah. tell me, what did you do different? I mean, what was the missing link? I mean, where was it not being realized its potential?
I think a few places. If you went to those shops, they were very much branded with the chocolate bar or Jacques Therese. There's a lot of chocolate bars on the market, much more in the last 4 years. But, you know, so we added the chocolate bar selection to the mix. We made a dessert menu where every dessert has an element of chocolate. And so it was allowing you to come in and not just buy a piece of chocolate and have an espresso, you know, at a counter. It was come in and really savor and try to learn a little bit more about, you know, chocolate and its various forms.
Do you buy chocolate from all over the world?
Well, I mean, yes, chocolate is produced all over the world, mm-hmm. And we buy it through distributors. But we're also working very closely with, for instance, a company called Madagas, and they're producing chocolate in Madagascar. And they have a very philanthropic side of their business, which is what we're latching onto as well. So, yes, we do buy chocolate from all over the world.
I wanted to ask all about sourcing, but back to the thing about, like, when the chocolate renaissance came. I know, like, bread, mm-hmm. it was, like, the 80s. I mean, the cheese as well.
Yeah.
It was a big microbrewery revolution. I mean, is chocolate just part of that, and it was just a matter of time before it came to that favorite, cherished food?
Yes, I think so. I think you have a much more refined general population in terms of their palate. Mm-hmm. And so anytime you have something where there's territory, for instance, with the cacao, and you start to taste the difference between your average dark chocolate bar and then, let's say, a single origin Madagascar bar, mm-hmm. there's, you know, most of the time there's no comparison.
And had we been eating really horrible chocolate? I mean, was it like the rest? I mean, did it used to be great, then the culture went down, and now it's on a renaissance? Or was it never really that good in America?
I don't think it was that good in America, which is the point. I believe, you know, in France and Belgium and other parts of Europe, they had refined the production much more than Hershey's had here. I loved Special Dark as a kid, but, you know, have a Scharfenberger semi-sweet bar, and it's just no comparison.
No comparison. Yeah. I agree with that.
Scharfenberger.
It's owned by Hershey's.
Yes, exactly.
but prior to them selling out, you
John Scharfenberger. Yes. And actually a very sweet man who passed away, unfortunately. His name was...
His name.
Come to me.
Yes, I have his book, and I'm
Robert Steinberg?
Yes, right. Yeah.
He's a great guy, and I remember him taking me on the tour of that first machine, that mixer.
Yeah. John Scharfenberger has done a book signing and a little tasting in our shop, and just that guy, his knowledge is something to behold.
Well, it's very, very interesting. We will come right back on the main course with Katie Kiefer and I'm Patrick Martins, and we're really excited to have John from the Chocolate Room and Roger from the Gramercy Tavern.
Okay, it sounds like we're back. Woohoo! That was quick. It's Katie Kiefer speaking here on the main course with Patrick Martins of Heritage Foods. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We're sponsored today by the Hearst Ranch. And we are having a show on chocolate. We have John Payson from the Chocolate Room, who's been telling us all about how that works. And we also are thrilled to have Roger Rodriguez from the Gramercy Tavern, who is their chocolatier. And as we were saying before the show opened up, it's pretty unusual to have an in-house chocolatier, Roger. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how that came to be at Gramercy, and then we can continue our conversation about sort of chocolate and the rise and revolution of chocolate tastes in America.
Mm-hmm.
So welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for having
Thanks,
me.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you, Patrick. The way I started at Gramercy was working my way up in the kitchen, just like a regular cook.
No kidding.
Yeah, definitely.
So you didn't go to like pastry school, culinary?
Well, I did went to ICE, Institute of Culinary Education, and graduated from there, moved to a couple of restaurants, worked with some really, really famous chefs.
Uh-huh.
When they were doing their chocolates, I used to just look at them.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in charge of the chocolates then. I was just look at them, go home, melt chocolate, mold it, then take it out, then do it again, the same process until I got a little good.
Mm.
Then I start working on other restaurants with chocolates. And when I end up in Gramercy, working my way up, Nancy, the pastry chef at Gramercy, she offers me the opportunity to run the chocolate program.
Uh-huh.
And what does that entail exactly? Like, what is your week-to-week work by running the chocolate program?
Well, basically, we do a four-day chocolate production. Then the other ones, I just cover whatever they want me to cover, you know, any position they want me to cover. But we only do, we not only do chocolates. Nancy is a big fan of chocolates, and she incorporates those chocolates to the pastry menu.
Mm-hmm.
The bonbons and chocolates that we do, for example, for Chef Mike's tasting menu, Michael Anthony, we use that for the all the chocolates for it. And there you go. You have a little box over here.
Thank
yeah, Roger,
you, Roger.
Roger brought us a little
this
sample.
Go great with my beer. I love chocolate beer.
They really go great with beer.
So, Roger, what's like the what's the specialty? What's your personal favorite chocolate to work with? And what do you like to make? I mean, do you make filled chocolates or truffles or I mean, oh, my God, those look beauty.
Those look pretty, don't they?
Those are very, very professional looking.
Oh, thank you.
So tell us, you know, like, what are you making?
Well, we usually a seasonal restaurant.
Uh-huh.
So I try to do whatever people see on the farmer's market.
Oh, so you use a lot of, you incorporate fruits into
fruits,
your chocolates?
Yeah.
Yeah, these are
so
what
do you make, like, fruit filling?
Mm.
That is a strawberry pate frit with an amaretto ganache.
A strawberry what?
Yes. a strawberry pâte frit with amaretto ganache.
Pâte frit, oh yeah, got it.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And what are these little beehive-shaped ones?
Those beehive-shaped, those are amaretto.
That's amaretto.
Yeah,
amaretto. Now, is that a classic shape for the amaretto? I've always wondered, you know how people have, like, when you look in a box of chocolates and every different flavor has a different shape? Is that, like, a classically determined form, or is that something that is unique to each chocolatier?
Not this one. I'm really not into following other people's traditions.
Mm.
Very good.
Is it bad form to taste each chocolate shape
and
then
put
it
back?
I think that's kind of accepted.
It's accepted around the holidays. Yeah.
Yeah.
It would not be accepted in my house.
No, but not fine chocolate. You can do that with Russell Stover. Nothing against Mr. Stover, but.
And where do you guys source? Where is most of the chocolate made? I mean, it's cacao. I mean, give us the history of, you know, origin, or whoever wants to answer this question. You know, origins all the way up to when we just put it in our mouth just now. What is the chain of production?
Yeah, what's the process? Let's hear that.
Well, the process starts with harvesting the cacao, and then it goes through a fermenting and drying process. And then, like,
in the place of origin?
Well, it can. That's starting to be sort of the new model for fair trade.
Okay.
But it's not happening enough yet, although we sell chocolate from Madagascar, produced in Madagascar. Chocolate from Ecuador, produced in Ecuador, and some from Mexico right now, all produced in country, which is helping to further the economic gains of the individual farmers as opposed to a middleman. So it goes from there, or if it's not produced in country, then the beans are shipped to processors, who then make it into chocolate, which we use in the kitchen, or we melt and make into confections.
Huh.
What kind of chocolate do you, I mean, do each, obviously each country produces a slightly different kind of chocolate? Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, is
so do you like, yeah, that's what I'm asking.
Well listen, there's different kinds of grapes in wine, yes, right? So there are different cacao. There's basically three types. There's Trinitario, Forastero, and Criollo, which would be the cream of the crop. But the bean that's coming out of Ecuador is called the Arriba bean. So there's a lot of different strains, but a cacao bean is essentially a cacao bean, but the territory and the soil and the conditions under which it's grown.
They divide it by where the region is between the equator.
Mm-hmm.
So they divide it like that by Criollo, Trinitario.
Right. 10 degrees north or south of the equator is basically where cacao grows.
And pretty much all the way around the world,
yes.
Right?
Yeah,
yep.
Basically, yeah.
Does it make a difference, like, in the quality or texture of the chocolate or the flavor of it? Like, if it's sourced from the north or south of the equator, do you have like a sense of like, oh, I really want for this particular chocolate recipe, I really want beans from Ecuador as opposed to, Africa? Or
I'm not so sure about that.
You really want to taste good stuff.
Yeah.
And Criollo is like,
Sure, you're going to pay a little more.
Exactly, you're going to pay a little more, but you're going to have like really, really good stuff. And
yeah.
The Criollo ones that comes from Venezuela,
yeah,
Santo Domingo, mm-hmm, and places like that,
that's really the
really good stuff. Yeah.
Do you do you buy from, like, I remember a long time ago I did a pitch for a company called Peter's Chocolates, which is a wholesale chocolate,
mm-hmm,
company. It was started by Daniel Peters, who was Nestle's partner back in the 1880s.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went out there. They're located near Hershey, Pennsylvania, and we tried the chocolate. It wasn't that great. But they do sell to a lot of very high-end chocolatiers. And is that how, I mean, do you guys have to go through like a sort of a processor like that, or do you?
Yeah, there's usually a middleman, although if you're using enough chocolate, you can buy directly. For instance, there's a company called Belcalat from Belgium, and they sell a lot of bulk chocolate. But their chocolate's quite good, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody's taste is different.
For us, as a restaurant, we not a big mass production chocolate place,
right?
So we don't have tempering machines. We don't have everything is by hand. So we don't need that big amount of chocolate.
I see.
To just go.
So who do you buy from?
We use a lot of chocolates over there. For example, we use Guitar, we use Varona.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. So you're buying bulk chocolate like those.
Exactly, yeah.
Like the big bar of Calibo that I bought the other day at Save Bars.
Because they, by buying in bulk, must get access to some of the better, you know, yeah. areas. Or
yeah.
I mean, it's hard to temper that amount of chocolate.
Yeah.
By hand.
Yeah. But a lot of the companies, even the large companies, are now recognizing the value of territory and single origin, which is why Hershey's bought out Scharfenberger. But even within the line of, let's say, Belcalade, this mass producer from Belgium, you can now get single origin, Costa Rican or Venezuelan chocolate.
It's almost like coffee in a way.
It is. I was told that that chocolate is where coffee was, let's say, 20 years ago. So it is exploding, but it's still in its infancy in that from that point of view.
In that respect, it's similar to the protein market, the sustainable protein market.
Well,
in
let's
chocolate.
Say
we should grow together.
It's not like a Valentine's Day thing no more.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you could go and get chocolate.
Oh, true.
Cadbury egg. We have to take a break, but when we come back, I want to ask if there are any massive companies that are still, considered quality chocolate makers, like Lindt and Nestle, mm-hmm. and do they make good chocolate? What is good chocolate? What's not? It'd be interesting, because I grew up on the Milky Way and Three Musketeers. I would presume that's not, but we'll take a break on the main course and come back and talk more about chocolat. So here we are talking about chocolate on the main course. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
So do any big, massive companies make great chocolate? Or are they all just bad because they're big? Like, can you mass produce, quality product?
Yes, you can. And I think any sustainable business has to follow the trend. So, yeah, Valrhona is a huge company. I love their 66% Carib. It's fantastic.
Really good.
So, yes, they have to. But their quality, for instance, Varona, has always been high. And then you have Michel Cuisel, which is another producer from Paris, and they're pretty much a mass producer. Quite expensive. I started using their milk chocolate in our hot cocoa when we first opened, and then I looked at the price we had to pay, and I said, it's great, but we're not making any money. So, yes, they can definitely, and they do produce very good chocolate.
What about Cadbury in England? I mean, do they have a better mass-produced industrial, candy bar chocolate in England than they do here in the
States? I've read that, yes. I've read that. Well, they've passed laws now in the UK and in France about you can only use cocoa butter, you can't use any other vegetable oils or things like that, whereas in the United States, we don't. Haven't had that kind of, focus on the quality. So I have heard that. I had heard that a Cadbury tastes very different in the UK than it does mm-hmm. here in the States.
I can vouch for that, absolutely. Yeah, because I lived in England for a year, and Cadbury chocolate was kind of like main staple of my diet.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in those days, there weren't many other options. And, you know, it was just like in this country. I mean, that was back in the 70s. And in this country, too, there were very few options for – there was Toblerone here, and there was Lindt you could buy in New York. But that was about it. Otherwise, for the rest of the mainstream America, it was Hershey's or Nestle's. And well, there really wasn't a lot in between.
I think it's the same as asking if a mass – produced winemaker can make good wine. Of course they can, but most of the really fine wine comes from the smaller producers.
Right.
Maybe because they are have more attention to the artistry or what have you. But I will say the great thing about working in the chocolate business is people will show up on your doorstep with chocolate. So a gentleman came in about a year ago, another Ecuadorian producer called Picari. And one of the finest chocolates I've tasted is his 70% raw bar. Hmm. It's unbelievable. I'll have to bring you some. It's unbelievable. So, you know.
Well, I have to come by your store. What will someone experience? So they walk into your store, and what do they see?
Chocolate.
They just see a whole display of chocolate.
Well, yeah, we work with a chocolatier named Fritz Knipschild, who's from Denmark. He's pretty well known now. He's gotten
pretty sure there's a pretty lady too there.
Yes, of course, of course there is. But,
yeah, that's all the chocolate.
Careful.
that's my wife.
Yeah, so there's a case full of beautiful confections, and then chocolate bars from all over the world, if you will. And then a cafe to sit down and partake.
Hmm.
And some port wine. And
oh, good. So you have a liquor license, too.
We have a beer and wine. We do a lot of dessert wines and ports.
Yeah, of course you do. Sure, because that's a great combination.
And we have chocolate wine. We have chocolate beer. So, yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, it's fun.
Roger, before we wrap up our chocolate extravaganza here, which I guess we have a few more minutes, but let's talk a little bit about the process of making chocolate. I mean, having been in the food business myself for a long time, chocolate has always been a very scary product, which has clearly a mind of its own, much like the egg. I always used to joke about solving the mystery of the egg because it can just screw you up in so many ways if you don't know what you're doing. And I know that chocolate is the same way. So when people talk about, like, tempering chocolate,
oh my goodness.
Tell us what tempering is. I know it has something to do with altering the temperature, and
tempering,
but it has to be really careful. And
not really. Temper chocolate for people sometimes is really intimidating.
Oh.
Yeah, because you see the results at the end of the temper.
Mm-hmm.
For example, when you melt the chocolate, you have to bring it to a center degree. It depends on which chocolate you're working with. For example, Verona or Guitar, they have different temperatures of temper.
Uh-huh.
Their chocolates. And when you temper the chocolates and you want to melt, for example, 55% chocolate, you want to bring it to like 130 around there. That's at least how I do it. I bring it to 130, then you bring it down in temperature, and then back up to work with it.
Why
do you do that?
Well, you want to melt all the cocoa butter in the chocolates. Then by an agitation that you do on the ball, I do it by hand, by the agitation that you do on the ball, you want to incorporate all the cocoa butter with the chocolate to form just like a uniform, clean, and glossy paste.
Uh-huh.
So when you do the chocolates, for example, these ones that are molded, you want to temper, then you put it on the then what you do is when you test it, you are looking for a shiny, it's really brittle, and it sets at room temperature. Like if it's not on temper, it's going to be really nappy and really
streaky,
and you're just going to touch it, and you're just going to leave your fingerprints in it.
Uh-huh.
Like look at those. I was here really early, right?
And yeah. They're
still
perfect.
Yeah, they still hold
them. And
their
they're at room temperature.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He's making it sound easy. It's not.
Yeah.
Well, it's really not. It's okay. You get used to it. You get used to it.
When you add fillings to it, what does that do to alter the chemistry? Because basically you're talking about a chemical change by raising
well,
and lowering temperatures.
Those fillings are ganache, and is created by an emulsion of cream. And chocolate together. So what you do is you first bring the cream to a boil.
Right.
And then you pour over the chocolates. And that heat is just going to start melting the chocolates.
Right.
Right. When that happens, you're just going to start moving the chocolates to emulsify. That you create an emulsion.
Right.
And it's going to be a really, really creamy texture.
Yeah. I remember making that at some point because I remember making a lot of truffles. But
yeah.
They were horrible to work with. And we didn't coat them. We just, like, rolled them in cocoa butter. Yeah. And it was gross. I mean, I remember having to stay in. I remember being in the walk-in for, like, hours rolling truffles.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, it was gross.
I mean, really hate working with cocoa powder.
Yeah.
It's so messy. It's so messy.
But the ganache is really...
It gets all over. You go in there white and you just come out brown.
Yeah.
That's what's in the air conditioning filter.
Exactly.
In the
Now, has anyone ever made fish dishes with chocolate? I mean, are there things with which chocolate does not mix?
Well, I really love my job and I really don't. Go to that.
I would suppose that, you know, in some of the Mexican recipe, I mean, there must be a fish
mole,
right?
Okay.
But
I think people overstate the presence of chocolate in mole, don't you think? Where are you from, Roger?
I'm from the Dominican Republic.
Oh, so you don't, yeah. Mole is not your
I don't
thing,
mole at all.
No. I've made mole, and there's like the amount of chocolate in that is pretty minimal. I mean, people make it sound like it's a chocolate paste, but it's really chilies, and it has a tiny bit of chocolate in it.
So what's the future of chocolate in America? I mean, do you think there's going to be, you know, dozens more? Do you think there'll be a chocolatier in every restaurant or a store?
I think I am the future.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I don't know. No, it's not going to be a chocolatier in every restaurant. I mean, this opportunity just came up to me because of Nancy, so my passion for chocolate. And she was like, you know what? Why not? Just do the chocolates. And it's under her supervision, so
mm-hmm.
Can't be that bad.
Right.
So... I do those chocolates, so it's going to be really weird when there's a chocolatier in a restaurant. Has to be, I don't know, really, really high-end restaurant. Like
the Gramercy Tavern.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
And stores, do you think there'll be a chocolate shop in every neighborhood one day, the way, like, there's a bakery on every neighborhood, like 30 years ago there wasn't?
You know, it's hard to say with where the economy is right now. The low-end chocolate sales have actually gone up, whereas the higher end have maybe remained flat or gone down a little bit. So given the state of the economy, I would say that's going to affect whether or not you see more chocolate shops. But if I go by the number of people that walk in the door at the chocolate room and say, oh, I'm opening one of these in Keokuk, Iowa, then it's like, oh, yeah, then perhaps that is what's going to happen. Yeah.
What about the craze for nibs? I've noticed that nibs have been making it, you know, a big comeback, if they've ever been.
Well,
I think nibs are really overrated, personally.
Are they just leftovers?
Mm. No, they're the thing that you grind up to make chocolate, right, guys?
Well, it's pieces of the roasted bean, and if you take that and cover that with a little chocolate, it's fantastic. And actually,
okay.
You're going to get, well, that's a, you know.
It's an individual
subjective.
Taste, but,
yes.
You know, I've seen them showing up in all kinds of weird places, and, you know.
I mean, we used the nibs at Gramercy for a chocolate nougat semifreddo, and we incorporate the nibs in it to give it a little crunch, and it's really, really good.
Yeah.
And we serve it like on a little one bite portion on a lollipop to make it really fun. Yeah, but it's really good. I guess it depends who works with it.
Well, we have one dessert called the Scoops Nibs and Chocolate Port, and it's a scoop of vanilla ice cream with chocolate-covered nibs. And the chocolate, I don't know, it's fantastic.
Do you cover the chocolate? Do you make the nibs yourself?
No, we got those from Ecuador, from Vintage Chocolate Company, who the gentleman, Pierrick, who owns the company, lives in Park Slope, but they produce
it. Pierrick and has his thing out in New Jersey.
Yeah, he's just starting to produce there.
When we, before we worked with Pat LaFrieda Meats, we used to deliver our pallets to Pierrick's warehouse in New Jersey until his USDA guy or whoever his official was like, why is there meat blood all over your chocolate factory? And
oops.
But he was very good. My business partner, Sarah, used to work with him. What is the average price that someone will spend if they come and sit at your place? I mean, what's your average check?
Oh, the per person is probably $10. It's reasonable. We have pastry chefs. We're making the chocolate cake fresh every day. Matter of fact, we make all of our own stuff. We make our own ice cream. Everything that's on the menu is made in house, but it's a little bit more expensive. But I went to Gotham Bar and Grill the other night, and our desserts are a little less expensive than that, and I think as good. So, but it's, you know, you're paying for the atmosphere and all of that. But we, you know, it's pretty reasonable.
And just in case people don't know, cannot tell how hardcore these two guys are, they're both wearing brown. brown hat, brown shirts, so they go all the way brown.
Yeah,
this band.
Right. He's got his chocolate band of power around his wrist.
That's how we temper chocolate.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. This has been really great. Like, yeah, I never thought we would do a chocolate show, and then Katie pulled it together, and very, very interesting, the whole dessert end of the food world.
Yeah, I thought it was
not
fun
just
to take a trip off the center of the plate, as it were, and and talk about something, you know, some of the other big trends that are happening. And certainly desserts are a big part of any restaurant, and I think the growth of sort of specialty chocolates is something that has been very interesting to me over the past 10 years watching that grow up.
It is about – it has taken off. So we will take a short break. We're going to get a little honey update and a little update on a slow food event that's
coming up this week.
Some people from Beirut.
That's right.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thank
so
you
much
very much
for coming.
Thank
out
you,
Payson, Roger Rodriguez. Great to have you on, guys. Thanks
Thank
a
you.
Lot.
Thank you.
Log on to heritageradionetwork.com for more information about these guys.
Chocolate experience with the wonderful Roger Rodriguez from Gramercy Tavern and John Payson from the Chocolate Room.
Very interesting.
And now we have John Feldman in the studio from Frankie's Spuntino. And the reason we brought John in is because he's got a very cool secret, which he's going to share with us now.
he's been on before. It was very, very fascinating. But these are, you know, updates. I mean, so much has happened. I don't think the hives were even in when we talked. So
yeah,
tell us a little bit about what you're up to, John.
Yeah, so last time I was here, we were doing all the preparatory work for, you know, all the bees that we were going to be receiving. And so since then, we've installed 4 hives total all over Brooklyn on rooftops. And it's going really well. There's been a few snags along the way, but really it's been a great journey. We've been in, we've had bees in since about middle April, and today was kind of a milestone for us because it's the first time that we were able to actually start making honey. Hmm. And there's a lot of things that go on, but bees make honey constantly, but there's only a certain portion of their work that you can tap into.
Mm-hmm.
Because they eat the rest.
Because they need the rest, and you don't really want to mess with some of the where they store honey. It can be around where the queen has been laying eggs, and there's new bees hatching. You just don't really want to mess. It's kind of a vulnerable area. So,
mm-hmm.
We've added one of the boxes. We have these box hives, which are called the Langstroth hive, and you really stack as they grow. And there's a certain portion of when they're growing, you can separate out the queen, and they just make honey in some of these other boxes. So that's what's happening now.
And did they accept the queens, and the tenants are okay with bees on their roofs? I mean, have you, what have the obstacles been since you
yeah,
got
I thought, frankly, I thought beekeeping was illegal in New York.
It is illegal. There's legislation that's very, very, very close to being passed, and we're hoping to get grandfathered in. So we don't really disclose the locations. But mm-hmm. in terms of the real estate, everyone who's involved is totally involved. We have hives on people's roofs that are either helping us with the project or support us, and we're all good friends, and so that hasn't necessarily been a problem. The queens have been fine with the exception of one hive. When they arrived to us, the queen had passed away,
oh.
Wow.
Which was a bummer. And as a result, the bees took on a very strange, they went feral, I would say,
mm-hmm.
and started making hives in all these different places on this roof, and We ordered another queen, but it was the wrong breed. So
they went crazy.
One of our partners, Brandon, who is one of the owners of Roberta's, calls it the Marcy Project. So, it's still serving a function, which is they're still pollinating, and we're not only doing this for honey. We're doing this to help, you know, spread the knowledge of beekeeping, you know, to get the honey and to learn as much as we can about this so we can, you know, keep doing it and helping others start the same sorts of things.
I was going to ask you, what was the genesis of this project?
Yeah.
So it's really, it's almost a humanitarian effort to kind of,
very
well,
much.
I'm sure everybody has read the stories about collective, what is it?
Colony collapse disorder,
CCD. And they haven't, you know, they've gone through a series of different suggestions or hypotheses about why these colonies are collapsing. And they haven't really identified, as far as I know. At first, you know, there was a rumor that it was cell phones, cell towers,
yeah.
was like scrambling the bees, you know, and they didn't know where they were going. Because they do a very specific dance which directs the bees from one patch of flowers mm-hmm. to another, so they know
exactly.
where to go to get
which
their
I used
stuff.
To think was a form of intelligence, but then I think that it's
no,
just...
It's totally intelligent.
It's very, very complex and interesting what they do. And so then that wasn't it, and then there was some thought that it was some of the pesticides that were being used
which
on crops,
addiction to chemicals.
And then the other thing is, which I did not know but learned recently, is that they actually... beehives are trucked around the country
mm.
in order to pollinate large tracts of the Midwest. For instance, all that corn that we're growing
right.
wouldn't really be happening without the bees that we're trucking around. And so somehow, even though they've been doing that for years, maybe there's some difference in the way that's happening. I don't know.
I think it's really a multidimensional. It's a multidimensional problem, and there's a lot of different things. I think the main thing is our addiction to chemicals and our need to control our agricultural,
to grow bigger
and
bigger harvests.
Genetically modified things like the Monsanto Corporation, There's stuff that they're involved with. And
sorry to interrupt you, but do you think that genetically modified seed stock is having an impact on the bees as well?
I think it absolutely does. I mean, I think, like, you know, just take the Roundup Ready soy, you know, mm-hmm. some of these crops like that. I mean, it's just, it's really awful how much pesticide, you know, is dumped into these fields just, you know, to keep the pests away or the disease away.
And yet the whole point of GMO is to minimize the use of pesticides and chemical fertilizers. The idea behind Monsanto was initially to breed resistance to pests so that they wouldn't have to use so much chemical and mm-hmm. they wouldn't have to use so much fertilizer. And so it's kind of ironic if indeed it turns out to be that these genetically modified crops, okay, they need less chemicals, but the actual pollen itself is somehow having an impact on the bees.
It's so crazy.
It's really hard to say, you know.
No, I was just going to say, Carlo Petrini always said the highest form of technology is always the original natural thing. To say that it's more sophisticated to genetically modify, and then you cause another problem, then you have bee colonies collapse, it's a friggin' mess.
Right. And it's true. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but I think this colony collapse disorder has only just started in the last 4 or 5 years, and that's, I think, when these Monsanto crops, which, okay, granted, they've been doing GMO for maybe a dozen years now, but it seems to me that that has become more and more the norm over the last probably half decade.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the start of colony collapse, I can't comment, but I know that it's been coming out more and more in the last 4 or 5 years. And, and like I said, it's multidimensional. I mean, a lot of it is weather change. You know, bees leave their hive when they think it's warm,
mm-hmm.
and then they get far out, and then all of a sudden it starts getting cold again because it's the middle of February or March.
Huh.
And that happens enough times that this many bees die. And then they don't stay warm in the hive because they rely on each other to, you know, create heat and keep themselves warm. So, you know, there's all kind of reasons. But the bottom line is that the more people educate themselves about, you know, beekeeping, you know, how easy it is, it's really an approachable hobby and a great thing to do for the planet. You know, the more people that do that, the better. And I think it's possible for us to kind of save this from happening, you know.
Do you worry about how, you know, the Gowanus River and all that are going to, like, affect the taste of the honey? Because the taste of the honey is the kind of...
Is the taste of the pollen that they're collecting, right?
Yeah, interesting question, because when I first decided to do this, I was taking more of a purist approach where I was like, you know, I'm going to do it deep in the heart of Pennsylvania and, you know, where a specific oak tree grows, you know, like...
You're like, I'll commute every morning.
Okay, yeah, exactly. And then I started thinking, like, it's a little bit silly. Look, you know, I don't know yet, you know, but I think, and I was talking about this with one of my colleagues the other day, which is he said that he can't grow stuff in his backyard without adding soy because he has such a high lead content in his backyard in Brooklyn. And he's like, how's that going to affect the flowers that the bees drink from? And I said, wow, that's a really good question. I think, you know, a lot of people are growing, they have backyard gardens, they have rooftop gardens, there's trees around. I mean, I think there's an element of that, you know, but I think for the most part, people are using their own soil, and the bees are, you know, the bees are getting whatever they want. I mean, they go to the botanical gardens, they go to, you know, someone's, you know, windowsill, they go
to...
How far
do they go? A couple miles?
They can go, we have Italian honeybees, which are known to go 3 to 4 miles one way to forage.
That'd be funny in a blind tasting, you know, the vocabulary words, you know, you're like, I taste a little bit of crack file. A little bit of pure sludge.
Gowanus,
but it was still very good. I'm still going to give it an 8.
What breeds do you... just one more question, because I know we have one more guest to come on. But what... You ordered your... You're talking about ordering bees from different places. So
right.
You have an Italian bee. I guess the American honey... The honeybee is not indigenous to the United States? Is
right? Honeybees are indigenous to, from what I understand, Europe and the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did a lot of research on the type of bees that we wanted, and we went through some wonderful breeders in Georgia mm-hmm. called H&R Apiaries. I spoke about that the last time I was here. I definitely recommend getting from them. They have great genetics. The bees are very healthy. They're vibrant.
What's that, H&R Apiaries? H&R
Apiaries. You can look them up. You can Google them.
Or you can link to them on our site, too.
Yeah, I think they're tagged on one of the previous shows. And the North American honeybee, at this point, I think there's just so much crossbreeding that, you know, that happens that it's hard to really pin down what the genetics truly are.
Mm-hmm.
But there are, you know, general things that you look for to figure out, you know, which breed you have. And the Italian honeybees are, in my opinion, the prettiest. They're very orange and, bright looking, and they have very distinct black lines on their backs.
And they make really yummy honey?
They make really yummy honey.
Yeah. The best honey I've ever had came from South America.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I mean, I was into honey for a while, tasted a lot of different kinds.
Well, thanks for coming on again. Hopefully you'll be on more.
Yeah, we need a regular update on this. This is a really cool project.
There might be a Frankie's radio show here, spinning some vinyl.
My owners, Frank Castronova and Frank Falsinelli, are really excited about that. Yes,
that sounds great.
That'd be really cool. All right, and I'll see you Wednesday night at Frankie's Spittino, best place in Cobble Hill.
Thanks for coming on, John. The that's great. Room. All right.
Thanks, guys.
About all the topics we care about.
And what I love, I look out at Roberta's and we can pull guests just from who's sitting outside in the beautiful backyard garden.
That's right.
Where we have
snorkeling down these incredible pizzas and all of the good other good stuff they have to offer.
Well, Katie, I just got back near the food arts offices. I was at Ilili, a Middle Eastern restaurant, actually Lebanese mostly.
Lebanese-inspired, yes.
Lebanese-inspired. And, man, I had Rakibe, which my mom used to take me to a restaurant called Sido on Lexington Avenue.
Oh, yeah.
And they always made Rakibe. And then since then, I've always had trouble finding it or finding a good version. And I had it at lunch. And it was served beautifully with a long plate with ice and the kibe and onions.
Beauty.
And the tabbouleh was so fresh and delicious. You know, I don't think most people know what tabbouleh is supposed to taste like.
No, it's kind of a nasty parsley salad here.
Well, you know, it varies, unfortunately. It varies so much because it goes from being very grainy to not having any bulgur wheat in it.
Yeah.
And that's, in my opinion, a result of the growing ability of the country. So in Lebanon, they were very blessed. They have a lot of sun and a lot of water. So tomato and parsley are very prevalent in the dish. While if you go all the way to Morocco, you'll see a lot more
much more wheat-based.
Exactly, because they don't have access to to all those beautiful vegetables.
Well,
this
we
is a Philippe Massoud, by the way. That wasn't Patrick or Katie who said that. That was a Philippe.
You have a wicked good radio voice, man.
Exactly.
Whoa.
Well, I just got out of bed. No, I'm just kidding.
So Philippe is the chef at this beautiful restaurant with all family style, you know, seating, and we were just talking about tabbouleh. So what are the differences between, you know, what does Middle Eastern food encompass? I mean, what countries it goes, what's the span?
Overwhelmingly, it's the Ottoman Empire's influence on the region. Mm. That's the base. And then you have agricultural consideration that influences, in addition to French influence, for example, in Lebanon per se, or Syria, where both countries were French colonies. Mm. In Lebanon, you also had the Italians, amongst others, and everybody left a bit of their own little mark, so to speak. But in the end of the day, I really think it's the farmer's ability to grow produce that really influences what goes on the table.
Well, Lebanon has always been the breadbasket of the Middle East. Isn't that true? I mean, you have the most temperate climate, I understand.
Absolutely.
And the biggest selection of fruits and vegetables. So.
It is referred to in the Bible sometimes as the land of milk and honey.
That's right.
Because it has the four seasons and the four climates within a very small geographical location. And therefore, really, everything grows, and they make superb wine, let alone, you know, everything else.
Right.
The country, you know, just got out 18 years ago from its war, so to speak, and now it's starting to really rediscover itself from a culinary perspective and an agricultural one. And the slow food movement, for example, in Lebanon is really taking root. Organic growers, you know, while before everything used to be shipped from France or Europe at the restaurant level, especially, you know, mushrooms and all that, everything is now getting grown in Lebanon, even jalapenos and all that.
Fantastic.
Good stuff.
Now, you're here to promote a slow food event, so let's hear a little bit about that before we have to wrap up. So
sure.
Then you'll have to come back, Philippe.
Yeah, no, obviously we're going to
really
need Philippe
topic.
Back. We have
yeah.
4 minutes, though, so you don't have okay. to go too fast.
I'll try to speed up the enunciation.
The slow food movement.
No, but tell us why. I mean, you came today for a specific reason, so let's hear.
We are hosting Rami Zurek, who is also at the American University of Beirut and heading the slow foods movement in Lebanon. He also did an amazing book that goes through every village in Lebanon and what the villages produce and what is specific to each village. So there's a recipe per village, so to speak.
Fantastic.
It's called From Akkar to Amel. It's a great book which is going to be available at the slow foods event that we're hosting on the June 19th, and it starts at 6:30.
June 19th, 6:30, and how do people buy tickets to this event?
They can contact Camille Broderick at the restaurant at 212-481-1840.
212-481-1840.
Yes, and for slow food members, it's $90 a person, and for non-members, it's $100 a person. And a substantial amount of the proceeds is going to benefit, believe it or not, New York City schools, in addition to the slow food movement in Lebanon.
And what will you show, what will this event be, recipes from the various villages?
Ilili is sort of a bridge between the old world and the new world. We are very keen on preserving authentic flavors served in a contemporary setting. So we will be giving some old school dishes and some interpretive dishes just to push the envelope a little bit. And the menu is still being drafted. It's still macerating in my head. And probably within the next 48 hours or so, I'll be, you know, emailing it to all those that are attending so that they can plan ahead and fast maybe for the day because there's a lot of food to be eaten.
Absolutely.
So when you talk about pushing the envelope a little bit, Philippe, what are you talking? Like, give us an example of how you push sort of traditional, authentic Lebanese cuisine into something that's...
Well, sure, sure.
Changed up a little bit for the current day.
It's very simple. The cuisine has been very, in my opinion, understated and untouched. There was a lot of fait accompli kind of attitude towards it, while in fact, new techniques and proper techniques have never been infused into the production of food. It's all been grandma's recipe this, grandma's recipe that, and never, you know, what is the absolute perfect way of roasting an aubergine, you know, without smoking it with wood, you know, so to speak, and so on and so forth. And we do a lot of that. Illili is a laboratory, in all honesty. We haven't even scratched the top of the iceberg. There is so much to be done with this cuisine that, you know, it's for us, it's like being archaeologists, because we pull up dishes and we try to give them the most flavor, and it's an amazing journey. I'll give you a small example. You know, we did the sorbet of tabbouleh. Our executive sous chef Eric also was very, you know, contributed a lot to that. We do wasabi baba ganoush with a sashimi of yellowtail and a lemon soy sauce. So there's really a lot to play with. It's infinite. I cannot tell you. I'm like the kid in the sandbox, because I never get bored, really, in our kitchen. There's just...
Well, it's also such a big, beautiful space. I mean, it's got two of the nicest private event rooms that I've seen in the city, you know, because you look through the whole restaurant and very reasonably priced. But the kibbeh. I'm telling you, that raw kibbeh, if Americans could taste it once, there would be kibbeh stands all across the highways. If they could prepare it this good.
Is that the equivalent of a steak tartare? Only yes. You use lamb?
Yes. Well, no.
Is it lamb or beef?
No, I go with beef. I find lamb to be a bit excessive. A little greasy. A little gamey as well. It's all beef made in a unique method. But I highly recommend that you drink arak, which is the equivalent to ouzo. When you are eating it, it's really delicious with that. So
I'll have to come back.
Absolutely.
I didn't have arak.
Yes. Well, we will have it together, and then we'll make sure that we walk each other out of the restaurant.
Good. I know.
You don't have a sound effect for that, Patrick?
A sound effect for drunken walking out.
That's what I was thinking of.
Well, very, very great event. Philippe, you're going to be on again for sure. I mean, we did not even touch the surface of what we could have, but our main goal for today was to talk a little bit about Illili and, of course, slow food. Anyone that supports slow food is a friend of the Heritage Radio Network, and we wish you guys the best of luck with that.
Thank you. Thank you. Much appreciated. And look forward to coming back again.
Sorry
Thank
to drag you all the way to Bushwick.
No, it's my pleasure. I love coming here from time to time. There's a lot of undiscovered places. And it brings you back to a normal sense of being, so to speak, when
exactly.
You get out of the city.
Solar Pace, right by the Empire State Building, is not very slow. But anyway, Katie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Patrick.
You are a
thank you to the
most valuable player of the network again this week. That's
thank
3 weeks going now.
Going to keep going.
And your special someone is going to be the guest.
My
on
special
the next
someone
show?
Is going to be on the Q Report. Yes, Curtis B. Wayne and Chris Diamond. Curtis is an architect with over 30 years of experience, and Chris Diamond is also an architect and a designer of LEED systems for sustainable building.
Wow.
So this should be a really interesting show. I hope to. I hope it gets everybody thinking about how best to proceed with. You know, pushing legislation and making people build the right way.
Exactly.
So that's
awesome.
Next on the Q Report. Stay tuned.
And next week, by the way, fish, right?
I hope
we
so.
Think? Yeah,
yeah,
we'll see. Play it by ear, but at some point we're going to talk about
fish.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All right.
All right. See ya.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.